One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I'd like to thank Motley Fool for sponsoring this episode. I've said before on ads that looking after yourself financially gets harder and harder with the cost of everything going up. Being a tight Scotsman, I use every method I can possible to save a little here or make the most of what I have there. Motley Fool is one way that you can definitely look to maximise your income from investments. The age of stock picking is here with towering inflation and elevating interest rates. Sticking your money in a passive market just isn't going to get you what it used to, but it doesn't mean you have to abandon the market. There are still ways to invest for the future. You just need to know where to look, which is where the Motley Fool comes in. The Motley Fool Stock Advisor Service highlights two stocks each and every month for members to add to their portfolios, and it literally is paid to listen to them. Historically, their average stock recommendation is up over 400% as of April 10th, 2023. And listeners of That UFO Podcast can now access Motley Fool Stock Advisor for just $89 for their first year, a full $110 off the list price. What are you waiting for? Visit fool.com/thatufo. That's fool.com/THATUFO to start your investing journey today. $110 discount off of $199 per year list price. Membership will renew annually at the then current list price.
I am George Knapp, listening to That UFO Podcast and having one hell of a good time.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and for a change, I'm not going to introduce the guest because I'm not entirely sure how to introduce the guest best. Many of you have been excited for this show. I announced it a couple of weeks ago, but due to various different things and everyone's personal lives, we've had to reschedule. But I am delighted to welcome all the way from the hallowed halls of UFO Twitter and his own Substack account, I have Tiny Klaus, or Klaus. How you doing, mate?
Hey man, how's it going? Good to be here.
It's going well. It's good to have you on. People were very excited when I said you were going to come on the podcast, and albeit I think that was 2 months ago to the day almost that I said that was going to happen. But listen, here we are. These things happen for a reason. I've said I'm not sure how to introduce you because I was thinking, do you say social media commentator? Do you say blogger? Do you say researcher? Or how would you introduce yourself to an audience who may be listening wondering who is this guy?
I would say writer, first and foremost. I just kind of started writing on Reddit a couple of years ago. I started really digging into the UFO thing. I had been interested in it for a while. I had some sightings and kind of a paranormal experience back in like 2013 that really kind of, you know, was made an impression on me. But it was only like about 3 years ago now that I started really digging into like the theories and stuff like that. And you know, when Elizondo was doing all his interviews and it really kind of caught my attention that someone as serious as him was saying the things that he was saying, you know, and I don't know, it really just kind of like was like, okay, this is pretty intense stuff. So I kind of just started researching and posting on Reddit, RUFOs. It was kind of the place where I, you know, put all my thoughts, basically. I would, you know, watch interviews and kind of take, you know, the breadcrumbs, that quote unquote breadcrumbs that he laid out.
Yeah.
And just try to connect them to certain things that were more tangible. You know, science articles or stuff, you know, other people have said that that checked out and just kind of, you know, put pieces together that otherwise, you know, people wouldn't have on their own.
Well, that's it. I think for me, for anyone listening, wondering again, still, who is this guy? And many of the social media followers will know you because you're very prominent on there. You have like 31,000 followers and counting on Twitter, you know, which is a hell of a lot. And for me, I started noticing your tweets and in that form of the breadcrumbs and the research and a statement's been made in an interview by Jim Semivan. And the next thing I would see, it would be your Twitter timeline would be filled with excerpts from a book from Valet or a comment from Gary Nolan somewhere. Or actually, Lou Elizondo said this in an interview. And in your Twitter headline and on this podcast episode, it says patterns tell stories. And it's just, like you say, putting those pieces together that, you know, this isn't an isolated statement someone made. Mm-hmm. There's a background, there's a context here. And for folk like myself, that's incredible because I can look at that and go, ah, that's a really great talking point, or that's really interesting. And it's a place to jump off of and dig more into the subject. And that was always really appreciated and helpful for people like myself, and from there signing up to your Substack, and your articles are incredibly well researched. The, you know, all of that is a gold mine for a podcaster, so thank you for me. So your own background, you mentioned some of your own experiences. How far back does your interest go in this topic?
So I guess back in high school, I was a quote unquote like troubled teen. So I went to a wilderness program, therapeutic wilderness program. And that was kind of my first sighting, was in the woods there in Utah. And it was just kind of like a star moving in the sky. It got like big and kind of just shot off and, you know, one of those. And then, you know, I kind of didn't think about it for a long time. And after that, like in college and stuff, I had another sighting that was more vivid, I guess. And I had it with another person who was in the car with me. So that was very validating.
In what way?
It's kind of just that you, like I had someone else, my roommate was there, you know, just to experience it with. We were driving home from a party and it was a gray metallic disc with like really, you know, neon green on the outside of the disc. And it kind of came down the windshield very slowly. So it was, you could tell it was kind of far away. And then it kind of hovered there. It was about 500 feet away from the car. And then it just shot off. And then we just looked at each other and, you know, I was like, what the hell? So that was kind of, you know, an experience you have with someone else was much different than me just seeing something by myself in the sky, like wondering if I was, you know, seeing things or something like that, like having someone else there to, you know, kind of talk about it and just check to make sure you're not going crazy.
Can I ask, because this interests me, whenever someone has an experience with someone else, what was the conversation like immediately after? Was it a conversation? Was it, oh, let's put the radio back on and head home?
Yeah, it was just like, what the F was that, you know? And then just asking each other over and over, that was a UFO, right? Like that, I mean, it wasn't much more than that. Cause you know, and it kind of just turned into, you know, we just watched Ancient Aliens all the time and kind of got, you know, into it like that, just still casual, but like I started looking up, like, you know, there's a face on Mars and that kind of thing, you know,
because that sounds like myself. That's familiar.
So I'm like, yeah, let's dig into this a little deeper, but nothing past like, you know, the YouTube videos that were like
in a rabbit hole,
conspiracy theories.
You know, mm-hmm. You go down the rabbit hole, you start looking up various links and tweets or YouTube videos. And I think for me, it got to the point I was watching the Andrew Basiaggio videos of Mars jump rooms and him and President Obama's kids, you know, going back and forward in time. And for anyone who's went, what? Yeah, I've mentioned him before on this, but look up Andrew D. Basiaggio.
I don't know that one. I have to check it out. That sounds wild.
Yeah, his talks. I don't think he's done anything for a while due to ill health, but it was one of those like pinch of salt things. And if you listen to this and you believe what he says, fantastic. But at one point, he was due to be president in 2020, then 2022 or 24, whatever it was. The last couple of elections, he was due to be president in his claims, but the timeline changed. So it's one of those pinch of salt, incredible if true. But really, we would need Barack Obama to come forward and confirm that he did do this as a kid with this guy. But yeah, it was that deep rabbit hole for me. Growing up and watching this stuff and going, wow, imagine that was true. And then you find the Linda Moulton Howe stuff where she's talking about, I have this story from a Marine who, you know, served under the ice of the Antarctic, and this is what they said's happening, and all that stuff that gets really deep. And we're going to go there. We're going to go to Atlantis soon in this conversation as well. through a mutual friend, you know, if you want to call him that. A friend of everyone's, I suppose. But who do you look up to in this topic? Because you retweet and tweet and write about a lot of big names and big ideas. And being someone similar age to myself, who are some of the names you look at and go, these are the men, the women, these are the individuals that for me are worth listening to?
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, when I was writing on Reddit, Elizondo was, he was someone that I trusted and I still trust.
Why?
You know.
Why Lou?
Because he had the credentials. You know, before that, was it Greer who was the, you know, main voice, trusted voice?
Probably,
field,
yeah.
You know, so this guy steps out and, you know, he's an actual government official. And I, you know, if I had seen something that made me question, you know, where his story essentially, I would have just moved on. You know, I don't, and that's happened with certain people in this field, and that I just don't, you know, they've said or done something that makes me go, eh. And then I don't really, you know, include them in my research anymore. But with Elizondo, he's never given me a reason to doubt, you know, what he says. I mean, there's been, you know, the sock puppet, whatever that was just whatever to me. Like, you got to defend your family and shit like that. But
yeah,
besides that, I haven't seen anything to make me think otherwise when it comes to trusting him. So.
That you mentioned names you've moved on from in terms of research. Is there anyone in particular? Not that it's, you know, mudslinging or throwing shade at people, as the kids say these days, but was there anyone? Because I think that's a natural thing in this topic, and it's fine that you have, I've always said about allowing your opinion to be fluid, and I think you have to in this topic, and sometimes you'll be proven wrong, or people you look up to will be proven wrong, and it's fine to look and go, actually, I used to believe this, or I used to be in this camp and I've moved over to this one now. So is that what happened with yourself? And would you say maybe who it was?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually very, very recent.
Okay.
It's like a fresh wound, but, and I know you, I think you just had him on, but, I've come to question some of the stuff John Ramirez has said.
Okay. That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah, the thing with the alien doll where he was doing an interview, and then the Anjali stuff is,
That's a big one for people at the Anjali Association, I know. And after John was on, and listen, I've said John's a lovely guy to speak to, and he's been very gracious with his time with me. And I brought that up with him on the show to say, you know, there's a lot of people that the Anjali stuff really turns off if the claims you make aren't incredible enough. And it was fair, and he went there. He didn't tell me not to ask, and hopefully I probed enough that people were happy with it. But yeah, I think that's still a massive disconnect for me with that relationship and association. So that's fair comment.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, he probably has the most knowledge out of anyone I've ever heard talk about, you know, the CIA and the programs and the you know, the different departments and what they do and the sensors and stuff like that. He has a really deep knowledge of that. And that's obviously what made him seem credible in a lot of people's eyes, and including my own. And, but the recent stuff has just been like, kind of, yeah. It's hard to square that with the credibility that this topic really needs right now.
Everyone's got a line, and I think that's fair. And I've had it on listener call-in shows or with guests, and I've got my own lines, and they move now and again as well. I've said before, I struggle with a lot of the orb conversations, and people send me videos and stuff, and I say it looks like dust, it looks like a bug, it probably is, you know. But who am I to question that? I've had my own sightings that I've no proof of. It's just testimony, just my word against someone else's. A lot of respected names have made some huge claims recently, none more so than Gary Nolan at the SALT conference just last week, I think it was, where he said on stage, among many claims, he's 100% sure we're being visited by a non-human intelligence. What goes through your mind when you hear a Gary Nolan, a Tom DeLonge, you know, in the sense that he is a world-famous rock star, multimillionaire rock star and entrepreneur, a Jim Semivan, you know, with his credentials and background, making some of the incredible claims they are on big public stages and platforms?
Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's kind of what a lot of my writing encompasses, is these, you know, credible individuals, in my opinion. So if that, I can understand why people are skeptical about the claims these people are making, because they're huge. And, you know, as of right now, you know, there hasn't been, you know, definitive evidence of a lot of these claims, basically. And, but I mean, it's, you know, for example, Gary Nolan saying that at the SALT conference, that's a pretty serious venue. You know, especially for someone who is known, who's, you know, he's invested in biotech companies, and, you know, he works in that arena a lot. He's you know, top 20 inventor at Stanford, which is no, and that, you know, that's part of the credibility, I think, that lends him, like, he knows what he's talking about. I don't think he would put that on the line, you know, if he wanted someone to invest with him in something important ever again. Why would he go on stage in New York City at this giant conference and say something that's just so untrue, if it is untrue? You know, it's...
Yeah, Gary Nolan has a lot to lose, or has a lot to lose. And exactly. Like you say, his credentials, his background, he doesn't need to go begging to the UFO community for money. Mm-hmm. You know, he could write a book if he wanted to about UFOs and make some money. But Gary Nolan has a huge list of accomplishments behind him. He's a serious guy. He'll be well funded, given his immunology research and all that as well. He doesn't need to sit on a stage, like you say, in a serious venue and talk about UFOs and aliens, avatars, all that kind of stuff, because you're going to get the side eye in those venues, aren't you? That, what is this guy really saying, what we think he's saying? We're talking as that NASA conference is wrapping up, obviously, as well. And they sadly opened up the NASA conference mentioning the abuse that the panel had received. And that won't be from UFO Twitter, I would imagine. I think that's from your other academics and other scientists who, like we saw with Avi Loeb that time on the infamous Zoom call, where one of his colleagues just, I can't remember the woman's name, she just kicked off at him, really unhappy that he was entertaining the notion of UFOs and aliens. And a few other people backed her up on this call, and I imagine that's what's happening to these panels as well. So, to make a long-winded point, a Gary Nolan doesn't need that hassle. He doesn't need to put himself out there, but he believes in this subject, and if he was going to quote-unquote grift, I'm sure there are many other arenas Gary Nolan could have chose to have done that would have been a lot more fruitful than UFO social media.
And you know, skeptics always talk about Occam's razor, and when it comes to grifting, like, what makes the most sense? Like, someone would just, like, throw their career in the trash, or their credibility, or you know, just for what? Just to talk about aliens on a stage in New York? Like, it just doesn't make sense. What makes sense is that there's something to this, and you know, he's trying to tell people about it because he's been closer than anyone else has, and has the ability to actually understand, you know, what's going on behind the scenes and try to communicate that. So I don't know.
I mentioned Tom DeLonge, and you very jealously received a retweet and endorsement from Mr. DeLonge a while back. You've tweeted a lot of his stuff though. I think it's safe to say you're somewhat of a fan of Tom's. That may be his music, but it also is his work in the UFO field. I'm sure, like many, there are sometimes things he's said or done where you've went, oh, I don't know about that. And I'm going to ask you about Atlantis stuff soon, because I think that's some of his wilder conversations. But what draws you to Tom DeLonge and his statements? You know, you mentioned Lou Elizondo, his credibility, his background, Gary Nolan, the credibility of the background. And then you've got Tom DeLonge of What's My Age Again fame.
So Tom, let's do a full disclosure here. He's like the reason I play guitar. He is, he's always been, you know, a hero to me. Actually, I actually got to go backstage to at a Blink-182 concert back when in eighth grade, I think. And, I got to meet Mark, but not Tom, unfortunately. So, that was pretty cool. So yeah, I was definitely a Blink fan. I, you know, have always like loved his music and stuff. And, but I honestly, I got super pissed off when he started doing this UFO stuff and like quit Blink and all that stuff. So I kind of didn't care about him for a while. You're kind of a dick. Angels and Airwaves is okay, but whatever. I actually enjoy them, but
and to be fair, if you ever look at some of Tom's tweets, 90% of the replies are or were Blink fans saying, will you please get back with Blink, will you please get back with Blink. So as much as his UFO statements were wonderful for anyone on UFO social media, 90% or more of the comments were angsty teenage fans or grown-up fans asking him to get back with Blink, and we've got that wish now. So but I can see why.
And so that's also, you know, and I was listening to Lou for a while before I kind of even took Tom's stuff into consideration. It's not like a fanboy of Tom and then latched on to his every word. It's like I kind of, you know, took the more upfront, credible government official, like, okay, there's something to this. And then I kind of dipped a little bit into what Tom was saying. And then the whole story about him writing the first Secret Machines book and then, you know, basically the CIA kind of freaking out and being like, who told him all this classified information? I'm like, oh, okay, there's something there. His advisors, you know, knew enough to, guide him in certain directions where it caught the attention of intelligence services. So there's probably something to this, and he probably has people talking to him that, are familiar with a lot of this stuff and what's actually happening. So that's kind of what gave him the credibility at first in my eyes, was who he was around, and, you know, the reaction to his book. And then obviously the biggest thing was the John Podesta email leak.
Yeah,
that he was, you know, proven to be in communication with really high up government officials about this stuff. And there was some sort of plan to get this information out. And, you know, obviously what's happened since then has been, you know, kind of a bummer, but, those emails were pretty clear about what was happening behind the scenes with Tom.
That was huge. The paper trail that came out from the WikiLeaks stuff. And do you know what, to be fair, nothing against it. Like, you know, John Greenwald, who I'm a patron of his, I've said that before, full transparency. Mm-hmm. I like a lot of John's work, don't always agree with him. And I said that to him when I interviewed him, but if that paper trail wasn't there, there would be huge question marks over Tom DeLonge's claims of who he was in touch with. Mm-hmm. And that sort of quashed that instantly, because you can question a lot of Tom DeLonge and his motives and his statements and what he's done and how he's done it. But you can't question that background, because that's all there for people to see. And that was quite a good thing for Tom. Are there any particular statements, to put you on the spot, that Tom made that really stood out or stand out to you as wow, or even like you mentioned elements of the Secret Machines book? And again, I'm still working my way through the audiobook of that. Shamefully enough, it's been about 6 months now.
It's definitely a kind of complicated book. There's like 10 different characters and they all like intertwine and all that stuff. But, I mean, specifically, I think, so the first book is pretty nuts and bolts, you know, like craft, programs, you know, breakaway civilization, international conglomerates, intelligence, agents, assassinations, that kind of thing. And, mm-hmm. But the second book is a bit more, out there. so that one's more hard to figure out what's real and what's not. It's harder to pick apart, the things that we might, seem, because a lot of it's weird. Definitely. Like it goes into stuff that like Jacques Vallée talks about, mm-hmm. Where with the more like folklore type stuff, like fairy rings and pretty out there stuff. So I really do enjoy that. It's harder to, piece together in a comprehensive way, like relating to, the current UFO push and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I like entertaining those ideas. And again, that's kind of what I do, is I try to like figure out how is this applicable? And it's not really applicable yet, at least with what we know in the public sphere when it comes to, UFOs. But, I like that kind of stuff more. But as far as what Tom says, I think, the concept of the Greek gods, being a major part of the phenomenon. Essentially, it's the end of the first book, which I guess I'll kind of spoil for you.
I was going to say, I kind of know some spoilery bits, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, essentially, it's, the Greek gods, like, left, and their equipment was left here, and now we have it, and we're trying to reverse engineer it, and essentially, it's very ancient alien-y in that way. So, that's kind of... a very interesting thing you can dive into and make connections with.
Do you think, taking that at face value, then, that the Greek gods, as they're written and talked about in our society, that happened? Do you think Tom's taken something he's heard and put it out there, or do you think there's a creative license used where Tom's heard or been told something along those lines, and he's basically made it, like many say about the Bob Lazar story? There's a lot of truth there, but a lot of BS. And if you just tell enough lies in with the truth, then you can get away with it. Do you think that's what Tom's done with the books, whether deliberate or not?
Could be, who knows? But I tend to think there's something to it. One of my articles I wrote, It kind of asks, like, where does mythology end and history begin?
Yeah.
Like, why would they make all this stuff up just for, stories to, they're just stories, that like to tell, to teach morals and stuff like that. Which I guess is totally possible, but, why did they all of a sudden stop telling stories and start writing history as it was? Like, I feel like, and then, they found Troy, which was a myth forever. So it doesn't make sense to me why they would just be, basing stories off nothing, I guess.
Hi, everyone. If you listen to the podcast on an Apple device, you can support directly by going on to Apple Podcasts and clicking the subscribe button. And for less than the price of a coffee per month, you can get early access to episodes in full, and no adverts or sponsorships like this one you're hearing now. It also supports directly to me at the podcast, so thank you very much. Also, don't forget to go and leave the podcast on Apple a 5-star review, and make sure you click the follow button too. Thanks. I think some of Tom's stuff, and I love reading Tom's stuff, and one day we'll get him on the podcast, but the Atlantis tweets always stood out to me when Tom done his, I think it was 7 tweets, what if Atlantis was a real place and wasn't just a story? And what if there was a civilization here before us? And where do you go with that? Do you think, again, is that the line for you? Because obviously I try and work out where someone's line is. You mentioned John Ramirez and Jarley, and that's the point you kind of go, nah, not for me, thanks. Do you buy into even that element of, is that what you're talking about with lore and mythology, that maybe this was real and the story just got lost or twisted down the line?
Yeah, so I definitely entertain that fact. And it's a very almost dangerous line there with, you know, the Nazis themselves were looking for this, like evidence of this lore. So yeah. It can get into really dark territory, and it's unfortunately tainted by, you know, that kind of thing where intentions are obviously pretty evil.
Yeah.
When it comes to that, but you know, it's, I don't know. I think there's something to it, and I'm not going to ever make any claims that where there's no evidence to back it up, but I think it's definitely fun to speculate and talk about. But you know, it's, again, there's no evidence except for, you know, pretty, yeah, like the ancient alien kind of thing. But I think Tom does it in a different way. That's more,
from a well-informed place.
Yeah. It's, I mean, so think about it this way, like that second book, right, was released, and Lou Elizondo was sitting at the table with him while he was signing copies of it. So yeah. It's like, obviously there's, you know, there's some sort of endorsement there, from him in some way. It's just kind of, you got to look at it from like, okay, who is, saying what about this stuff? Like I don't think Elizondo has ever directly contradicted Tom. I could be wrong, but, you know, he said, you know, he's kind of a bull in a china shop type of thing, but I don't think he's ever come out and said, Tom was wrong on this. You know, I think Tom might just say it in a more, you know, reckless way, but, that's kind of what he does. So
about a reckless abandon, one for the Blink fans there. Yeah, there
exactly.
You go.
Popped in my head.
Yeah. Listen, a lot of questions came in, and there's a lot of things I want to follow up on with you. So JD on YouTube asked, wanted to talk about your personal experiences with the phenomenon, and you've done that. JD, said you've got a very informed mind. What do you think the phenomenon is? Is that something even yet in your research, your thinking, your writing, you've been able to put down in a few sentences or, you know, a statement? What is the phenomenon?
Yeah, that's, I have no idea. But, you know, I think it's something that we can't really understand right now. I think Jim Sumyman says it a lot, that we don't have the ontology to even talk about it. And I think another way I like to think about it also is how Gary Nolan kind of described it as, you know, were the ants out in the garden, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And like, how do they communicate with us? Would they even want to?
Yeah.
Would they, you know, create a little ant that looks like us, and try to communicate that way? Would they, you know, try to go through our sensory apparatuses or whatever, and electromagnetically try to communicate something to us that way? But yeah, I think it's so abstract from a human perspective, but I think they are trying to interact with us in some way that, let's just say, I don't think it's ET. that's, you know, you can kind of filter things out based on what you know. And that's kind of one of the things I'm leaning away from. So
yeah,
I think of it more like everything on the table, and you start pulling stuff off, you know, the more you learn. That's kind of my way of looking at it.
First thing on that, would you completely remove ET from the table altogether in the UFO topic? Do you think that's something that needs to be taken off, or do you think there's an element of it?
No, I don't think it needs to be taken off. I think it might be irrelevant.
Okay.
So say, you know, say a life form evolved here, became intelligent, you know, a billion years ago, and then took off because of a cataclysm or something.
Yeah.
And then we grew up like here as humans, and now we are quote unquote top of the food chain. Mm-hmm. And then they come back and they've been living on another planet this whole time. Is that ET? So that's kind of the, it might not matter, this categorization we try to put on this stuff. I think it's probably more complicated than aliens or not. You know,
I think you see that in your writing and your articles, where it's a lot of crypto terrestrial stuff, and you know,
that's a fun one. That's up there for me too. It's definitely interesting.
So let's just talk about that now. Anyway, what do you make of the crypto angle? And that's what you're talking about. And for you, for anyone listening, again, people newer to the subject might be listening to this podcast for the first, second, third time, and be introduced to you. What is a crypto terrestrial?
See, that's the thing is that with these definitions, it could mean something different.
What's your definition of it? Because that's a fair.
It is. I would say indigenous to Earth. Is probably the main definition. I actually broke down kind of the whole definition of crypto, and it basically means hidden. And a big piece of the lore is that they live underground, and you know, have developed there, I guess, and kind of like a subterranean civilization. And some people, you know, it kind of ties in with cryptids like Bigfoot and that kind of thing. But what I think is most likely, and this is a big one where I try to tie in the recent science with, you know, the kind of lore, is that, you know, we have these recent discoveries that they're making with hominins from, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. And this,
I was going to ask you that. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was kind of what got me really into the crypto thing, was just, this species Homo naledi, it was discovered, I think, back in 2013 or something. I'm probably totally wrong off the top of my head, but, it was, I think, in December of 2022, they finally got, down into the caves that they were excavating for this hominin species. They finally were able to, you know, enter these certain caverns at the archaeological site, and they found out that the species was harnessing fire, and essentially it was a burial ground, essentially, and they were postulating that the species had symbolic thought, and funerary customs and culture, essentially. So I was trying to square that with what Homo sapiens were doing around that time. Mm-hmm. And the article stated that, you know, Homo naledi was probably, you know, using fire alongside us, essentially before us. So fire is, you know, harnessing fire is basically kind of a technology. So if we had, and it tied in with kind of Graham Hancock's theory about, you know, an ancient civilization living next to a more primitive one. And that's kind of what he bases this whole thing on, where, you know, all these ancient structures and stuff were built by a more advanced civilization. So I kind of took that and applied it to this, and it kind of fit like the puzzle pieces. So from there, I just kind of took it a little bit further in one of my articles. And now they're actually, I think in June, they're releasing all their papers, like peer-reviewed papers on Homo naledi. And there's apparently some pretty wild discoveries that are going to be coming out. And one of them, I don't think a lot of people have seen this video, but it's this anthropologist, John Hawks, works with Lee Berger is the main anthropologist on it. And then he's co-writing a book on Homo naledi with John Hawks called Cave of Bones. And John Hawks in February gave this presentation. It's pretty amazing, kind of previewing what they found. And they basically found evidence that Homo naledi was using tools to dig deeper into this cave. They were using fire to light their way and digging deeper into this cave, you know, using tools that they made. So if that's not kind of like the start of a book on crypto-terrestrials, I don't know what is. You know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of those kind of patterns are like, what is possible when you extrapolate it from here? That's kind of where my thoughts go.
So for me, I can see that there was another civilization alongside us, another type of humanoid, whatever you want to call it.
Sorry, my dog's barking.
No, that's all right. Get him involved. But how, or can you get from there where something else potentially left, or some people would say it was still here, whatever that may be, to the idea then that there is this other, which is manipulating us and using, you know, Tom DeLonge talked about, you know, the power of love and being jealous of us having a soul. Mm-hmm. Is that not then another offshoot of the whole conversation where something else is involved in this? Or do you think that's related to these other civilizations that could have been around maybe just before us?
It could be. This is where I, you know, and maybe I'm kind of lazy for not committing to one thing, but this is where it's like all options are on the table, you know, if I'd run out of shit to write about, but I only really write about stuff that I think is actually possible based on the stuff that I'm researching.
Is that a line for you then, that the idea of other entities being jealous of us having souls and free will and no,
it's not actually. I mean, I think that whole part of it is kind of more AI based,
okay.
Where, you know, these, and it's definitely a more spiritual thing. So it's like the evidence, idea of evidence kind of gets, tossed out the window with the soul thing. I mean, you know, there's quantum mechanics and all that kind of stuff, which I do try to research and connect to it, but I can't really understand much of it because it's quantum mechanics. But that part of it, it would kind of make sense to me if a soul was real and it incarnates over and over, and then you have these, these nuts and bolts AI machines that, you know, basically fall apart over time. It would make sense that they might be trying to figure out how to, you know, take what we have and apply it to their own physical bodies, I guess. I don't know. Obviously, that's totally out there, but I don't know.
We'll get to that a little bit more in a second with another question. Sure. But talking about that parasitic beings angle, a listener on YouTube, Uwu, asked, is that something you would plan on researching, the whole idea of parasitic beings and manipulation of an others? Or is that hard to quantify for you in terms of here's the evidence of it?
No, because, there are parasites. They exist on our planet. There are articles, you know, essentially saying that it's as simple as, hey, rabies exists and it can make you angry. It can make you aggressive. So there is a parasite or, a virus that can change your behavior.
Yeah.
Like that exists. So, you know, is there one that is perhaps conscious? Like what is consciousness? And then it's that kind of, thought, extrapolation, I guess, where it's you just keep asking questions based on the question before it, and maybe it takes you somewhere, maybe it doesn't, but that's kind of really how you build the house or whatever.
So you mentioned before about the beings potentially, and I'm going to talk about grey aliens. Question from Newman, who always sends in some really good thought-provoking questions. He asks, what are Klaus's thoughts on the reason behind the neo-human appearance of the grey aliens? And he adds specifically, what do you think of Dr. Michael Masters' future time-travelling human hypothesis versus Richard Dolan's speculation and alien agendas that instead an abducted ancient human group was evolved by non-humanoids as intermediaries to conduct work on Earth versus the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis? I hope I've read that in a way that it makes sense.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with Dolan's. I did read Michael Masters' Identified Flying Objects.
Yes.
And that really made sense to me. He's a smart guy. I think he got that book peer reviewed, if I'm not mistaken, which is pretty cool. Something like that. But I think, yeah, that makes sense to me. If you extrapolate what we look like at this point, and you go based off the cases that, mm-hmm. And the descriptions from those, it would make sense that it could be future human and they would look like, what we would look like if we, evolved in that way from now. So that does make sense to me. I think when it comes to grays, the Gary Nolan hypothesis makes the most sense to me, that they're trying to meet us where we are. They're trying to construct something that looks enough like us to where it doesn't freak us out, but just different enough to where we know they're different.
As he mentioned avatars, didn't he? Yeah, something else, exactly. Sending avatars that, mm-hmm. and your ideas that you think are, give it a head, give it two arms, two hands, yeah. two legs, two feet, a body. They'll get the rough idea that we're, yeah. That's what they look like to us. So
right, they're trying to communicate that they understand what we look like. What kind of, physical being we would interact with, like another human kind of thing. So there, and it's, he also says that it's almost like an intelligence test to see if we could recognize these beings for what they are and recognize this intelligence for what it's trying to communicate to us. I think it would make sense that the gray alien would represent that.
Well, I've got Dr. Michael Masters and Richard Dolan both on the podcast later on this month. So for anyone who's got any questions for both, Michael Masters has been on before. He's coming back on to discuss his new book, which is very different from his first, but pretty interesting. I've only managed to skim it so far, but I've got time to read it before the interview. And then finally,
a lot of cases in it. I think it's a pretty thorough case study. I think that's the difference.
It's non-fiction, but it's written like a script, so mm-hmm. it's the people talking to each other, and he's using stories to tell what the ideas are. It's all there, and if people read the blurb, I'm bastardizing it by doing that, but yeah.
I always bastardize stuff when I try to talk about
it. It's awful.
That's why I write. So I have everything laid
out. Don't put
out.
Me on the spot. That's my job on this, yeah. And Richard Dolan finally is coming on the podcast as well, but that's arranged awesome. For later on in the month, so I'm looking forward to finally speaking to Richard. Cool. Newman also asked, what is Klaus' opinion on the ET influence during World War II? And he adds, Linda Moulton Howe claimed during one of our Earth Files episodes that World War II is one of the first ET-instigated wars on planet Earth. See, this is where my line starts to blur. This is both hilariously absurd, but also scary to think of, effectively suggesting that certain odd obsessions of the National Socialists, like the Nazi Bell, racial traits, etc., came from their leadership having received a visit from the Tall Whites. Obviously, feel free to answer the question, but again, for me, that's when a line starts to blur between what really goes on and that sounds a bit fanciful.
That's tough. So I guess, I don't know if you know that, like that attack, the Mussolini crash, I guess from 1933. which was the fascist UFO files, I guess they called it.
Right. Yeah.
It's written by, or not written by, but it was researched by, I think it's Roberto Panatti. He's a ICER guy.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. I think he wrote it for John Greenwald's website, actually. But essentially, and I think Chris Sharp touched on it too, but
yeah. Do you know what? I had reached out to Roberto, I think through Philip Mantle, to potentially come on the podcast at some point, because he'd written on the Italian. Yes, that's where I know it from. He's I think he's got a case book on Italian UFO history. So yeah,
it's a really interesting case. And I think if you're really going to dive into that, that's kind of where you have to start, is in 1933. Apparently there's some cables or telegraphs between Mussolini's cabinet and about a crashed saucer. So that's kind of where, like, a lot of people say it starts, rather than like Roswell or Trinity.
I was dreading you saying Trinity, because I've not addressed that one yet after the recent D. Dean Johnson articles.
Yeah, that's a tough one right now. I'm kind of up in the air about that, but I think,
they're pretty damning, aren't they? They're pretty damning of the case from the extensive work done.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a tough one, but as far as the war goes, it's covered in secret machines pretty thoroughly. Like the whole Operation Paperclip thing was very real. Obviously, I mean, now it's being admitted to, but I think it's a huge part of the cover up and our current, our aerospace programs were basically infested with fascist ideology, and it's really uncomfortable to talk about a lot of the time.
Operation Paperclip and all that,
which is why I'm glad Tom did it in the way he did, in a fictional way, and I like that. If you've never read The Hunt for Zero Point, it's a really good book. Nick Cook dives into a lot of the nitty gritty of that too. And it's actually funny, because I'm pretty sure Tom took the henge structure that Nick Cook visits in Hunt for Zero Point. There's a henge structure which he kind of insinuates is connected to the Nazi Bell anti-gravity craft. And essentially, I think Tom took that henge structure and the mine setting from, that Nick Cook described in Hunt for Zero Point, and just put it into secret machines. It's described exactly the same way. It's pretty cool.
Going to follow on with Dave Smethers, asked a lot of questions, and Dave, I'm going to keep some of these for hopefully Klaus coming back on in the very, very near future to do a follow up, because I have a ton of stuff still to get through.
It's a good guy.
But Dave asks, what does Klaus think of the idea of a regular cataclysm cycle on Earth? If yes, do you think the government knows? Do you think so the occupants of the UAP know? You maybe touched on that a little bit before when you mentioned a civilization getting away because of a cataclysm. Are they collaborating to save us? And would this explain the UFO secrecy?
So that's a really interesting subject, is the circular cyclical cataclysm thing. And it kind of ties in with time, and what is time? Is it linear? Is it circular or cyclical or whatever? But I think it's definitely a possibility. This is all speculation, obviously, and it's tough when you're not a scientist to kind of hammer this stuff down in a way that like people would take seriously.
I mean, I'm not on anything, and here I am talking to all people like yourself about it. So,
yeah, me too. But I think it's definitely an interesting theory. I think it's been talked about a lot by, Tom has said, civilizations kind of rise and fall potentially in cycles. Maybe this is all just a test, or some sort of experiment that starts over every however many 10,000-12,000 years. And maybe someone figured that out and figured out how to get off in time, and chilled out somewhere else while it went down, and now they're coming back or something like that. I don't see.
So wait a second. So you're saying that someone else, the previous civilization, could have potentially figured out that there was a cycle of cataclysms, and let's get off before the planet blows up this time, or the ice age happens. Mm-hmm. Would that then suggest that there was something else causing the cataclysms, or
not
that
necessarily.
Those occurred naturally?
Yeah, it could occur naturally. Again, I'll quote Tom. He says it all the time. he says it has to come out because it's nature. And I kind of connect that to perhaps cataclysms of some kind. If it's just naturally happening, say like Planet Nine or whatever, comes around every once 12,000 years or so and rips off the, Earth's magnetic field, and everything gets completely screwed up, and everything starts over. What can we do about that? That's just nature, But yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking, that maybe, an older civilization figured out when that planet was coming, or when whatever happened, and got off, and like come back, basically. That kind of ties in with the Greek god thing that Tom says, that they left before a cataclysm and hung out at an outpost in the solar system. So that kind of jives with what he says too. So who knows,
someone hopefully knows, but it's fun to talk about. I want to hopefully make this not your last appearance and get you back on soon to dive into more specific areas in a bit more detail. So to start wrapping up, what right now is happening that's got your most interest? So literally today, as we're speaking, the NASA conference is wrapping up, which has actually seemed, I don't know if you caught any of it, but from what I managed to see, it was a lot more positive than I expected it to be. And that seems to be a lot of the consensus from a quick look on the socials as well, that people are going, okay, this might actually have something to it. It might have legs. You've got your Gary Nolans talking about, stuff to come, whistleblowers down the line, or witnesses, as Stephen Bassett said. God forbid I called them whistleblowers. He wasn't happy with that one. What's on the horizon for you that you're most looking forward to as such? Hopefully not a cataclysm.
Yeah, right. I don't, there's a lot of chatter about the summer, so whatever that is, I guess. That's the, I guess whistleblowers are the main rumor.
What do you see? What do you see? And I asked Dan this last week on the breakdown show. Realistically, what is the best case scenario then for you coming out of the summer? Where do you think we realistically could be?
There would probably have to be someone on the record who, had proof that they worked on one of these programs, these crash retrieval programs. That would be cool. Another interesting thing I think people should look out for was actually what Gary Nolan announced at that SALT conference, which was a 501c3, I think it's called. An organization where he's going to try to actually, get donations and, fund, write grants and fund some actual research on this stuff. And he's talked in the past about writing papers on more out there stuff like remote viewing and that kind of thing. And so if they actually kind of get funding for, the more, out there stuff, that would be really cool to see start take shape. Just this NASA thing was, huge, just symbolically and just for academia in general, just taking it seriously. The content I have problems with, but they're wondering why there's stigma when it's been 80 years of this shit, you're the public face of this, you should know. But that's what I think is really important though for the UFO community, is that these people they really like, they're like, we want to start from ground zero. And then they spend 30 minutes asking where ground zero is. So, you know, it's kind of like you need help, you need direction from people who've been studying this for a while. And I've only been doing it for, you know, not that long compared to a lot of other people in the community. So, there's only so much they can do on their own without, you know, being told where to look, essentially. But yeah, there's a lot of talk about like needle in the haystack, and we don't even know what the needle looks like, or, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, okay, so then ask someone who might be able to help, basically. But yeah, no, that NASA thing is cool. And I guess they said they're going to have a report out by the end of July. So have that to look forward to, too.
Well, you find a needle in a haystack, but you can find your articles on Substack.
Which are, there you go.
Yeah, there
nice.
We go. Yeah, I'm good at that. That's the only thing I'm good at. But for listeners, how can they find you? Because one, you've just got a podcast out, which is good timing, because you never had that in 31st of March when we're going to do this. But yeah. Also, you've got the articles as well, which I'm subscribed to. And if you've got any interest in reading about this subject and just some of the ideas that I've literally only touched on with Klaus, I plan to go deeper on a few things down the line. But how can people follow your work? How can they listen to your work? How can they read your work?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at TinyKlaus, TinyKlaus. Yeah, I'll tell you the origin of that name next time. And then, yeah, TinyKlaus.com is my Substack. I got a custom domain, so just, yeah, redirects there. And yeah, and I'm doing a kind of podcast thing, I guess. I'm just throwing it out there right now and seeing what the interest level is, and, you know, seeing if I can handle it, first of all, because you got a full-time job and writing all this stuff. But yeah, that's it's called Patterns Tell Stories, and it's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. It's just a small project right now, but we'll see what happens, I guess. Yeah.
Well, listen, you mentioned you've not been doing this in the grand scheme of things for too long, so we can consider you new blood, a new voice, a new face in the topic, much as myself or Dan, Chris Sharp, sorry to leave out so many others, Vinny Adams and Graham Rendell have been in this subject in recent years. And there's so many more people within that as well, that there are people that have done this for decades and decades and decades and have laid so much groundwork, and people need to carry on that work in whatever way the conversation goes. So your contributions have been massive so far for someone like myself, and I know many others. So thank you for doing the work you do. It's good, it's appreciated, and it leaves food for thought, which I really enjoy in this topic. And you can read it and go, I like that, I agree with it, I don't agree with that, but it makes you think. And that's that's always necessary, and you don't force those views or opinions on other people that this is definitely right and this is why. It's just, here's something I've thought, here's what I've researched, here's what I'm putting out there, and go make up your own mind. So I think that's a really good way forward.
Yeah, I don't think there's really any other way to do it. I have a hard time when people say definitively this is what it is. It's like, how do you know that? You don't know that.
My next podcast is How Klaus Is Wrong, and I'm going to be I was going to drop in a five-parter next week.
Perfect. It's an honor to be on here. You were the first guy I listened to in the podcast world when it came to this subject.
God help you.
I love your show,
actually,
man.
Start the bar low and work your way up. That's probably a good idea. So yeah. But no, it's been good having you on, and sorry it's taken so long. A lot of people have asked me about this several times, about when is Klaus coming on, when's it coming on, but it's done, it's here, and hopefully this is just part one of several more at least to come. So yeah, go check out his work, and thanks for joining us, Klaus.
Yep.
That is all for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. You can like, retweet and subscribe. That would all be very much appreciated. The shows are being uploaded onto YouTube as we speak more and more. You can sign up at patreon.com/thatufopodcast to access the shows ad-free as well. Please get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, thatufopodcast. Of course, on Twitter, it's at UFOUAPAM. And again, folks, as always, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer. More like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of
That UFO podcast is sponsored by Zencastr. Zencastr is the all-in-one podcasting platform that allows you to remotely record and produce your show with the highest quality audio and video. All from the main dashboard, you can find a full suite of professional tools to get your show created and published in the easiest way possible. You'll always sound at your best, as Zencastr's post-production takes the headache out of audio production, setting your loudness and levels while reducing background noise with one click. Zencastr records video up to 4K to give you the perfect picture quality, whether you're in a shed or a studio. Then Zencastr will distribute your video podcast in crisp 1080p to all video podcast players. The biggest feature for me, folks, is that I get the local file recording from each guest, so their audio always comes through as best as it can, regardless of any choppy internet connections. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use code UFOPODCAST and you'll get 40% off your first 3 months of Zencastr Professional. I want you to have the same easy experiences I do for all my podcasting and content needs. It's time to share your story.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.